Assalamu alaikum. Now, in our last episode, we covered the early years of Caliph Hisham ibn Abdul Malik's reign, a time that was marked by impressive ambition but growing strain. The Umayyad military, once the spearhead of unstoppable conquest, was now stretched dangerously thin. From North Africa to Central Asia, the empire's borders were increasingly hard to hold. We saw how Hisham tried to reassert Umayyad strength, dispatching his brother Maslama ibn Abdul Malik to the Caucasus, his sons to raid Anatolia, and his new governor, Ashraz ibn Abdullah, to manage Khorasan. But none of these campaigns brought lasting stability. Instead, they exposed deeper problems: discontent among the non-Arab Muslim converts, feuding tribal factions, and governors who were more interested in personal gain than public service. We also saw glimpses of Hisham's piety, his gestures of religious devotion, his respect for scholars, and his attempts to revive the spirit of jihad. But the military reality on the ground told a very different story. This story was one where overreach, resistance, and exhaustion were becoming the norm. And that brings us to today's episode. It's now 1:10 AH, and the pressure is mounting. The Khazars are pushing south through the Caucasus. The Turkish Khaganate is stirring rebellion in Central Asia. And in Samarkand, a wave of new Muslim converts becomes the spark that ignites a major revolt. And once again, the Umayyads are forced into desperate battles on multiple fronts. Today, inshallah, we'll follow these events as they unfold from the mountains of the Caucasus to the plains of Khorasan. What begins as a series of simple border skirmishes will soon spiral into something much, much more serious. Let's get into it. Let's begin with Maslama ibn Abdul Malik leading a campaign into the Caucasus to fight the Caucasus Khazars. Maslama's forces controlled a huge fortress called Babulan. Babulan means gate to Alan, or the gate of the Alans. Babulan was actually a pass through the Caucasus Mountains. Now, south of the Caucasus Mountains is the Republic of Georgia, and north of the Caucasus, in today's world, is the state of Russia. The Caucasus Mountains kind of acts like a border between Russia and Georgia. Babulan is also known as the Darial Gorge. Now, the Darial Gorge, you really got to see pictures of this. The Darial Gorge has these very steep granite mountain walls that are almost 6,000 feet high. The word Darial, from the Darial Gorge, the word Darial itself comes from the Arabic word Darulan, which means home of the Alans. The Alans were an Iranian people that had settled in this region north of the Caucasus probably around 500 years before the birth of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Now, where does this word Alan comes from? It's spelled A-L-A-N in English. We've mentioned it at least twice already, Babulan and now Darulan. So where does this word Alan come from? The word Alan actually comes from the same root as the word for Iran, like the nation of Iran, and also the word Aryan. Now today, this region where the Alans originally were is the Russian Republic of North Ossetia, Alania. So you can see that the name is still there. Now back to our main story. So Maslama ibn Abdul Malik, the brother of Hisham ibn Abdul Malik, he's leading his forces to fight the Khaqan of the Caucasus Khazars who had invaded this region. And now they were threatening Umayyad territory. I want to be clear here that this Khaqan that Maslama is getting ready to face is not Sulu, who was the Khaqan of the Turkish Khaganate that we discussed in the previous episode. Khaqan, as we mentioned in the previous episode as well, was a title used by many Turkic leaders of this time. We mentioned how there's some speculation that is probably very accurate that the word Khaqan is related to the Indo-Persian word Khan, which means king or ruler as well. Now, according to Tariq al-Tabari, the Muslims were victorious. That is, Maslamah defeated the Caucasus Khazars in this engagement at Babulan, or close to Babulan. However, it seems that this may have been a very costly victory. Maslamah may have won the battle, but it seems like it came at a very high cost. Listen to this quote.
Before finally defeating the Khazar Khaqan on 7 Jamaat al-Thani, 110, 17 September 728, or perhaps rather only breaking off the engagement, Maslamah's forces are said to have fought for a month or 40 days. The main recollection of the Muslims in this campaign was that of slogging miserably through the mud while it rained continuously. Maslamah's army was also ambushed as he retreated across the Dario Pass. Michael the Syrian even says the Muslims abandoned their baggage train and fled. In both campaigns of 109-727 and 110-728, Maslamah is said to have been faced by the Khazar Khaqan himself, campaigning in person for the first time, which would show the intensification of the struggle, just as in Khorasan at the same time. That Maslamah's persistent campaigning was hardly a success is indicated by the fact that the Khazars invaded Muslim Azerbaijan again in 111-729 when Al-Harith ibn Amr again repulsed them. The end of the Jihad state, the reign of Hisham ibn Abdul Malik, and the collapse of the Umayyads by Khalid Yahya Blankenship.
So inshallah, later on in this episode, we're going to discuss this Khazar invasion of Azerbaijan that we just heard in this quote. That's coming up very soon, inshallah. One interesting thing I came across while doing the research on this story was that Tariq al-Tabari mentions how Maslamah ibn Abdul Malik and his troops passed by a masjid called the Mosque of Dhul Qarnayn on their way back home. I used everything at my disposal, but the only reference that I could find to this Mosque of Dhul Qarnayn was in Alexandria in Egypt. And it's not even clear that this masjid in Alexandria that was once called the Mosque of Dhul Qarnayn ever really existed. If it did exist, that is the one in Alexandria, not the one in the Caucasus that Tariq al-Tabari says Maslamah passed by. If the one in Alexandria ever existed, then it was built during the time of Amr ibn al-As, radiallahu anhu, the great Sahaba. I haven't been able to confirm that the masjid in Alexandria ever existed, as the scholar who mentioned the one in Alexandria lived centuries earlier, and there is absolutely nothing that I could find, is absolutely nothing about such a masjid in the Caucasus. So this is my speculation. So this masjid, the Mosque of Dhul Qarnayn, it is mentioned in Tariq al-Tabari. There's no doubt about that. I'm certain that even by the time of Tariq al-Tabari, the masjid no longer existed. Allah knows best. But here's my speculation about what happened. It is possible that the early Muslims who first came through this region in the Caucasus, they passed through Babulan or the Dario Gorge, and they saw these high 6,000 feet high granite walls in the gorge, and they likely believed that these were the walls built by Dhul Qarnayn, as Allah mentions in the Quran. They believed that these mountains or these steep granite mountains were built by Dhul Qarnayn to restrain Ya'juj wal Ma'juj, Gog and Magog. At some point of time, during the period that the Muslims, when they first came to the Caucasus, up until the time that we are in our story, 110 AH, at some point, someone built a masjid there for Muslim travelers, maybe even soldiers coming through, and they named it Masjid Dhul Qarnayn. Allah knows best. And over time, the masjid may have either been forgotten or destroyed, but its name was passed down by the Muslims who remembered it. But as far as I can tell, other than this reference in Tariq al-Tabari, there's no other evidence that this masjid has ever existed. I don't doubt that it existed, but I don't think it exists anymore. And Allah knows best if these walls are actually holding back Gog and Magog. Allah knows best, but I doubt that that's the case. But again, Allah knows best. Okay, now back to our story. So we can see that the Muslim position in the Caucasus is starting to weaken. Caliph Hisham ibn Abd al-Malik, he would eventually dismiss his brother, well, his half-brother, but he would dismiss his brother Maslamah ibn Abd al-Malik as governor of Al-Jazeera and the Caucasus. He most likely dismissed Maslamah because he was dissatisfied with Maslamah's military performance. Maslamah ibn Abd al-Malik had not made any significant progress against the Caucasus Khazars during his years in command. In fact, he actually had lost ground in the Caucasus to the Khazars. At the beginning of Hisham's reign, the Muslims had held a strong position and strong control over the region up to the Caucasus Mountains, that is, in eastern Transcaucasia, or that strip of land between the Caspian Sea and the Black Sea that makes up the Caucasus. However, by 111 AH, the Muslim forces had lost ground and they were being pushed back closer and closer to Azerbaijan. So the situation in the Caucasus was especially troubling when we consider how close the Caucasus is to Syria and Iraq, which are, of course, the Muslim and the Umayyad strongholds. So overall, as I mentioned, the military situation, the military position for the Muslims is starting to weaken in the Caucasus under Maslamah's leadership. Now let's switch our focus over to Anatolia, where Muawiyah ibn Hisham is leading a campaign. We've mentioned in the past about the annual Umayyad expeditions into Anatolia. Annually, every single year, the Umayyads would send expeditions into Anatolia every summer and sometimes twice in a summer. First, there was the campaign on the left, or the smaller expedition. This expedition departed from what is now Cilicia in Anatolia, or actually Turkey. And most of the troops in this campaign of the left, they were from Homs, which is in Syria, and possibly Kunasrin, which is also or was also in Syria. And then there was the campaign on the right, or the larger expedition. This expedition on the right, this one departed from Malatya, and most of these troops were from Jazeera. And Jazeera is, of course, the region where the modern states of Iraq, Syria, and Turkey all kind of come together. And Malatya is, of course, also in the modern Republic of Turkey. These expeditions often included a naval element as well, but the naval side was relatively minor. Most Umayyad naval warfare was taking place in the western Mediterranean near Al-Andalus, and we have mentioned that in the previous episode. There was also supposed to be an annual winter expedition against the Byzantines in Anatolia, but around this time or this phase or this era of the Umayyad Caliphate, it didn't always happen. But the summer campaigns were generally regular. Those were almost never missed. These annual summer campaigns, and even the winter ones for that matter, these were really raids intended to extract plunder and wealth from the Byzantines. They weren't really about grabbing territory. Yes, the Umayyads would take it if they got it, but their thing was mostly extracting wealth from the Byzantine territory. The Umayyads under Caliph Hisham didn't really bother with maintaining or trying to expand their territory in Anatolia beyond the Taurus Mountains. The Umayyad forces, when they raided Anatolia, they demolished many of the central plains, central parts of Anatolia. And this time in 110 AH, being led by Muawiyah ibn Hisham, was no different. Generally speaking, when the Umayyads raided Anatolia, they didn't really bother with the coastal regions too often, nor the southern parts, the southwestern parts of Anatolia either. They didn't really bother with that so much. The central region, however, was open game. They would ransack the central region of Anatolia, and as they got bolder and it got easier for the Umayyads to ransack and rampage through Anatolia, they would go deeper and deeper into central Anatolia to the point where they were actually going into western Anatolia, which for the longest time they had generally avoided. And the Byzantines, for whatever reason, they did very little to stop these raids. We mentioned, I believe, in the previous episode that the Byzantine Empire had adopted a defensive policy with the Umayyads. They had these heavily armored fortresses, and they used these fortresses to guard strategic areas where they didn't want the Umayyads getting bust so close. But everything else was open territory. I used Google Earth to try to map out this region and try to explain what was going on. So if you go to my website, IslamicHistoryPodcast.com/UC4, that is U for Umayyad, C for Caliphate, 4 for the fourth episode, UC4, IslamicHistoryPodcast.com/UC4, you'll see some of the maps that I made showing the details of what we just mentioned. So during this campaign, 110 AH, Hisham's son, Muawiyah ibn Hisham, he campaigned in the summer and he captured a Byzantine fortress in Samalu. So now let's move on to Khorasan. Let's discuss the governor of Khorasan, Ashras ibn Abdullah, and the Mawali. We know the Mawali. These were non-Arab Muslims, generally speaking, former slaves. Ashras ibn Abdullah As-Sulami was the new governor of Khorasan. He had replaced the prior governor, who was Asad al-Qasri. We mentioned Asad al-Qasri was the brother of the governor of Iraq, Khalid al-Qasri. This new governor of Khorasan, Ashras ibn Abdullah, he answered directly to Caliph Hisham instead of through Khalid al-Qasri, which had been the previous norm. We discussed all this in a previous episode as well. So Ashras ibn Abdullah, he called one of his advisors one day and he asked him to recommend someone who could act as a da'i, as a missionary, to spread the message of Islam to the non-Muslims of Khorasan. This is a good thing, obviously. So the advisor recommended a man named Abu Sayda Saleh ibn Tarif, who was a maula of the Banu Dabba. You may not recognize that name, but we have actually spoken about him before. We discussed him in the previous season in episode 4-7. This was during the reign of Caliph Omar ibn Abdulaziz, also known as Omar II. This maula, Abu Sayda, he met with Caliph Omar ibn Abdulaziz, and he complained how the Mawali were being treated by the Arab governors in Khorasan. And the governor of Khorasan at this time was a man named Al-Jarrah ibn Abdullah al-Hakami, and he will come up again, inshallah, later on in this episode. So Caliph Omar ibn Abdulaziz, Omar II, he ordered the governor of Khorasan, Al-Jarrah, not to impose the jizya on anyone who prayed towards the same Qibla that the Arabs did, that the Muslims did. And when the word got out, this led to many people in Khorasan rushing to accept Islam. And so the governor, Al-Jarrah, he writes back to Caliph Omar and he suggests that they should check to see if these new converts had been circumcised to prove that their devotion was true and that they weren't just becoming Muslim to avoid taxes. But Caliph Omar, he wrote back and he said that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala sent Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam to call people to Islam and not to circumcise them. Abu Sayda now is the man who is recommended to act as the da'i to spread the Islam, to spread the religion, the deen of Islam to the non-Muslims of Khorasan. Abu Sayda agrees to take on this mission, but he has two requests from the governor, Ashras. He requests that those who accept Islam through him, the Mawali who accept Islam through him, that they will be exempt from paying the jizya. The only thing they will have to pay is the kharaj. Now the kharaj was land tax that all subjects within the Umayyad Caliphate had to pay. Whether it's Arab, non-Arab, Muslim, non-Muslim, doesn't matter. Everyone had to pay kharaj. So basically land tax. Now, to be fair, sometimes the terms for kharaj and jizya were kind of combined or intertwined and mixed. Generally speaking, kharaj just means tax. That might be an easier way of putting it, at least during the Umayyad era. Anyway, so Abu Sayda asks that the Mawali who convert, who accept Islam through him, would be exempt from paying the jizya. They only had to pay the kharaj. And he also asks Ashras, the governor, to support him in case the local Arab officials, the local Umayyad officials, try to stop him or try to cause any trouble. And the governor, Ashras, he agrees to both requests. So Abu Sayda, he goes off, he travels to Samarkand, and he begins calling the non-Muslims there to Islam. He told them that those who accepted Islam would be exempt from paying the jizya. And of course, many people rushed to Islam and rushed to become Muslim.
He sent Abu Sayyida, whom we have already met as a proponent of the Mawali in the time of Umar II, to Samarkand where, with the support of the local Arab governor, it was proclaimed that acceptance of Islam would bring with it remission of taxes. The result was a flood of converts among the local peoples, but also complaints from the local non-Arab notables and rulers that they were unable to meet their tribute payments now that so many of their people had become Arabs. The first dynasty of Islam, the Umayyad Caliphate, AD 661 to 750, by G.R. Hotting.